You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 212 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. As y'all recall, at the end of the last show, Don Carlos Buell had divided the Army of the Ohio into four columns. One column would make a feint toward the state capital of Frankfort, while the other three marched for Bardstown and beyond. Buell's plan was to bring the Confederates to battle and defeat them, or force them to fall back into Tennessee by threatening their line of communications.
The Federals moved out from Louisville on October 1, 1862. Meanwhile, Braxton Bragg had left Leonidas Polk in command at Bardstown, while Bragg rode to Lexington to finally meet up with Kirby Smith. Bragg officially took control of all Confederate forces in Kentucky, and then discussed his options with Smith. Bragg thought it would take Buell weeks to resupply and reorganize at Louisville, so Bragg decided that in the meantime, the rebels would consolidate their gains thus far and also install a pro-Confederate state government in Frankfort. A ceremony to do so was planned for October 4th. And that's pretty much where we left things last time, right? But it didn't take Buell weeks to get things sorted out in Louisville. The Federals actually set out again after spending less than a week in the city. Nevertheless, on October 1st, when Buell left Louisville, the situation in Kentucky was critical for the Union. The Confederate forces of Braxton Bragg and Kirby Smith controlled virtually the entire state east of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, and were on the verge of grasping the levers of civil government in the Bluegrass State.
All that's to say that Buell absolutely needed to wage a victorious campaign or Kentucky could be irretrievably lost to the Confederacy. So the stakes were high indeed as the Army of the Ohio moved out from Louisville.
The Federal columns left Louisville by four roads. Sill's 2nd Division marched east on the Shelbyville Turnpike, aiming for Frankfort, some 50 miles away.
McCook's corps followed the Taylorsville Road and formed the left flank of Buell's main thrust to the southeast.
Crittenden took the center on the Bardstown Road, while Gilbert's corps anchored the Federal right on the Shepherdsville Pike.
George Thomas rode with Crittenden's column while Buell accompanied Gilbert's troops. Union cavalry preceded the infantry, scouting ahead to locate the Confederates.
By the first night, the Federals were 10 miles outside Louisville and were well on their way, although the Green regiments had a difficult time of it. A lot of the rookies had started off carrying way too much gear and equipment, and they had quickly begun to dump items along the roads. Private Timothy Pendergrast of the 2nd Minnesota described how, quote, "We began to see fine new boots lying by the roadside, alongside of new blankets, shoes, fine shirts, books, and all kinds of trinkets for use or ornament. Scarcely half of the new regiments kept their place in the ranks until camp was reached. The remainder were scattered along the road for several miles, nursing blistered feet or aching backs. While of the veteran troops, scarcely one man was missing."
Buell's advance caught the Confederates by surprise. After weeks of campaigning, the mounts of the rebel cavalry were worn out, and the effectiveness of their patrolling by this point left much to be desired. Their federal counterparts, on the other hand, were newly re-equipped in Louisville and successfully screening Buell's advance.
The Confederate horsemen didn't detect Buell's march until October 2nd, and Polk reported this unexpected news to Bragg in Lexington. Polk's message that the Yankees were on the move found Bragg busily planning Richard Hawes' inauguration as the new governor of Kentucky on October 4th. Bragg assumed the threat to Frankfort represented Buell's main effort, although the Confederate commander didn't have any cavalry on hand under his personal command to verify this. And so, just based on his assumption that Buell was heading for Frankfort, Bragg decided to concentrate his army and Kirby Smith's force west of the state capital and offer battle.
Bragg wanted to use Kirby Smith's Army of Kentucky as a blocking force, while Polk brought Bragg's own Army of the Mississippi up from the southwest and smashed into the Federals' flank. To that end, the Confederate commander immediately ordered Polk to, quote, put your whole available force in motion by Bloomfield and strike Buell in flank and rear. If we can combine our movements, he is certainly lost.
But, crucially, instead of postponing the ceremony in Frankfort and taking command in the field, Bragg continued supervising the preparations for the October 4th installation of Hawes as governor. Meanwhile, Kirby Smith's troops marched for Frankfort so they could play their part in the battle that Bragg was planning.
When Bragg's orders arrived, though, they put Leonidas Polk in a dilemma, because to Polk, it now seemed clear that the Yankees' main effort was aimed at Bardstown rather than at Frankfort. Polk now understood that one federal column was marching directly for Bardstown, while flanking columns were also moving in the same direction. Each passing day brought the advancing enemy columns 10 or 12 miles closer, and by the morning of October 3rd, the Federals stood about a day's march from Bardstown.
That meant that if Polk moved as Bragg had ordered, that would cause the Confederates to collide with McCook's Federals near Bloomfield, northeast of Bardstown. Fighting through McCook's corps would, in the best case, delay the rebel movement to Frankfort, and in the worst case, would allow the rest of Buell's troops to concentrate and smash Polk's force. Caught between a rock and a hard place, that is, between Bragg's orders and the reality of the rapidly developing situation, and aware that he was outnumbered almost 2-1 by Buell's approaching columns, Polk needed to make a decision quickly.
Late on the morning of October 3rd, the bishop-turned-general called a council of war. After reading the order from Bragg to move through Bloomfield, Polk sought the opinions of his fellow officers. Only Patton Anderson, a diehard Bragg loyalist, argued for strictly following the order. But when he was asked what he would do if Bragg's order didn't exist, and knowing the Federals were in fact aiming for Bardstown, Anderson admitted he would withdraw eastward toward Harrodsburg, which was about 40 miles away.
Once this suggestion was out in the open, everyone agreed it was really the only realistic option available to the Army of the Mississippi. Polk later said, quote, we were all clearly satisfied as to the position of the troops of the enemy, which information we were sure the general commanding the forces could not have, or he would not have issued such an order. End quote. In other words, Polk and the other officers in Bardstown realized that Bragg didn't understand the true situation, so they decided to ignore his instructions and do what they thought was best. Polk therefore issued orders that the army would withdraw eastward. That meant that Braxton Bragg's plans were beginning to seriously unravel, and he didn't even know it yet.
While the Confederates prepared to evacuate Bardstown, there was an incident involving McCook's nearby Federals, which vividly illustrated the tensions that existed in a border state like Kentucky. It's important to remember that since it had remained with the Union, Kentucky, even though it was a slave state, was not bound by President Lincoln's upcoming Emancipation Proclamation.
Right. But on the evening of October 3rd at Bloomfield, an escaped slave appeared in the 21st Wisconsin's camp, followed in short order by three men chasing him and demanding his return. The 21st was a new regiment, having just been mustered into service on September 5th. The regiment's colonel, Benjamin Sweet, said that he would give no assistance to the men. The slave chasers then appealed to division headquarters.
The 21st Wisconsin was part of Colonel John C. Starkweather's brigade of Lovell Rousseau's 3rd Division. Rousseau was a slave-owning Kentuckian, and he ordered the fugitive turned over to his pursuers. This order should have ended the matter, but the aide delivering the message got into a heated dispute with some of the Wisconsin soldiers, and according to the 21st adjutant, the aide was forced to scamper, quote, out of camp with corn cobs flying in rather close proximity to his head, end quote.
Rousseau, to put it mildly, blew a gasket when he heard about the incident. Mounting his horse, he ordered the rest of Starkweather's brigade formed in a hollow square under arms, with the unarmed 21st Wisconsin in the center. A witness described what happened next. Quote, thus standing, he addressed the 21st, saying he would kill the man or men who attacked his orderly and was determined to find out who it was. Colonel Sweet immediately called upon any man who had thrown at the orderly to step forward from the ranks. A half dozen or more, without the least hesitation, stepped out. They were marched off to division headquarters and the parade dismissed.
Colonel Sweet and his officers appealed to Rousseau on the soldiers' behalf, and Rousseau, realizing he had overreacted in his anger, backed off and released the prisoners back to the regiment. In the meantime, the fugitive slave who had caused all this commotion escaped free and clear.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesey from the History of the Second World War podcast. My podcast is a mostly chronological retelling of the Second World War, and I hope you will join me on a journey through the most cataclysmic conflict in human history as we try to answer the questions of not just what and where, but how and why. Join me on a journey not just through the famous campaigns, battles, and events, but also on a trip around the globe as we broaden the scope of Second World War history beyond the well-known battlefields of Europe and the Pacific. During weekly episodes, I seek to provide new insight for longtime students of the war, while also being a great jumping-on point for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of the Second World War. This podcast has made it to the invasion of Poland in 1939, and start listening now to find out how the world would find itself embroiled in its second worldwide conflict in just 20 years. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Early on the morning of October 4th, the Confederates of the Army of the Mississippi abandoned Bardstown. Polk's right wing and Hardee's left wing started out east on separate roads, but they were never more than 10 miles apart and were in good position to support each other and also protect the vital Confederate supply depot at Camp Breckinridge, formerly the Federals' Camp Dick Robinson.
October 4, 1862 was Inauguration Day in Frankfort, and Bragg rose early. After receiving word of Polk's decision and actions, Bragg instructed him to fall back to Harrodsburg. Despite the fluid military situation and appeals from Kirby Smith and Simon Bolivar Buckner to postpone the ceremony in Frankfurt and focus on the advancing Yankees, Bragg nevertheless went ahead with Haws' installation.
Shortly before noon, Richard Haws arrived at the state capitol building to be installed as governor of Confederate Kentucky. A booming salute by rebel cannon announced his arrival, and he then went upstairs to the House chamber. The room was too small to hold the crowd that attended the event, and the overflow spilled out into the rotunda. Kentucky native Humphrey Marshall spoke, followed by a grandiose address from Bragg. Then Haws stepped up to the podium. Haws, while on the run from Union forces, had actually already been sworn in earlier that year in a sham ceremony in southern Kentucky, so now all he did was read a speech that pledged his administration would stay in Frankfort and that federal troops would soon be expelled from the state.
A luncheon followed the ceremony, but while the guests were enjoying their meal and looking forward to a ball that evening, artillery fire was suddenly heard to the west. The sound meant that Sill's Federals had arrived in front of Frankfort. Bragg immediately ordered everyone to, quote, skedaddle, as Kirby Smith put it, and the Confederates quickly abandoned the place. That night, Sill's troops reoccupied the Bluegrass State's capital, ending its month-long occupation by the rebels.
In the meantime, Buell had spent October 4th regrouping at Bardstown and then set out the next day. Gilbert's Third Corps took the direct road eastward, while McCook's First Corps and Crittenden's Second Corps marched on parallel roads to the north and south, respectively. Sill's troops left Frankfort on October 5th and started a slow march southward to join back up with Buell's main force.
Just 100 hours into the Union counteroffensive, Bragg was scrambling to find an adequate response to the threat. The Confederates had lost Frankfort on the same day Haws had been installed as governor, exposing that bit of play-acting for the farce that it was. And unless Bragg could fight and defeat Buell, the invading Confederates would lose the rest of central Kentucky as well.
Bragg frantically looked for a place to give battle, and he settled on Harrodsburg, about 30 miles southwest of Lexington, as the place to make a stand. The town wasn't far from the rebel supply depot at Camp Breckinridge, while the roads that came together at Harrodsburg would allow Polk's and Kirby Smith's forces to easily concentrate there. Bragg therefore rode south for Harrodsburg and ordered both Confederate armies to join him there.
Sparks flew as cavalry of both sides clashed while Buell moved eastward from Bardstown in pursuit of Polk and Hardee. Hardee had been forced to shift southward and now was being pressed closely by Gilbert's Federals. Joseph Wheeler's rebel horsemen managed to keep the Yankees at bay, even giving the Union cavalry a bloody nose at Pottsville on October 7th.
That evening, Wheeler's cavalry drew back about 2 miles to the vicinity of Perryville, a small crossroads hamlet where the two divisions of Hardee's wing had halted. The Federals stopped about 3 miles west of town. With the Yankees hot on its heels, Hardee's left wing of the army needed some help if it was going to be able to continue its withdrawal eastward. When Bragg was informed of the situation, he sent a message to Leonidas Polk telling him to take Benjamin Cheatham's division of the right wing and go to Perryville. The next day, October 8th, after taking Cheatham's men and linking up with Hardee, Bragg expected Polk to, quote, give the enemy battle immediately, rout him, and then move to our support at Harrodsburg.
So in Bragg's mind, the action at Perryville on October 8th was just designed to keep the pursuing Yankees at arm's length and give Hardee's wing some breathing space to continue withdrawing eastward. You see, Bragg still expected the climactic battle of the campaign was going to happen at Harrodsburg.
Exactly. Well, meanwhile, on the Union side, Don Carlos Buell rested on the evening of October 7th, nursing a sore foot caused by his horse falling on him that afternoon. Despite his pain and discomfort, he realized that he had run a part of the withdrawing Confederate force to ground at Perryville.
There seems to be some disagreement among some sources as to whether or not a meeting of officers in Gilbert's Third Corps occurred on the night of October 7th to petition for Buell's removal from command. Such a meeting on the eve of a battle would have been extraordinary, but there's evidence to suggest that while such a gathering did occur, and while it did petition Washington for Buell's removal from command, the meeting actually occurred not on the evening of October 7th, but weeks later, after the Battle of Perryville, when the Confederate and Union armies were no longer in contact.
Well, at any rate, one group of senior federal officers did gather on the evening of October 7th. Phil Sheridan met with James Jackson, William Terrell, and Colonel George Webster. Sheridan commanded the 11th Division and 3rd Corps, while the other three were in the 10th Division and 1st Corps. There was a nasty feud between Sheridan and Terrell going all the way back to their West Point days, but on the night of October 7th, the two men buried the hatchet and made peace. In the ensuing discussion, the conversation somehow turned to the minuscule chances that all four would be killed during the fighting that was sure to break out when the sun rose. Little did they know, though, that three of them would in fact fall in battle the next day.
As Buell's Federals had pursued Polk's and Hardee's Confederates eastward, the drought and unrelenting heat had taken their toll on the soldiers of both sides. Sporadic rain showers did little to benefit the parched countryside or ease the men's thirst. Most of the streams were dry, or nearly so, and the misery of the Union troops was increased by the fact that the thirsty Confederates in the lead usually depleted the water sources before the following Federals reached them.
By the evening of October 7th, 1862, the focus of the Kentucky campaign had shifted to one of the most historic areas of the Bluegrass State, namely the triangle formed by Harrodsburg to the north, Danville to the southeast, and Perryville to the southwest. Approximately 10 miles separated each place from the other. Harrodsburg dated from 1774 and was the oldest permanent English settlement west of the Appalachian Mountains. And just as an aside, but I'm actually pretty familiar with Harrodsburg since I did my student teaching at the high school there back in my senior year of college.
Danville had been founded in the 1780s and was the state's first capital. It was there that the first constitution of the new Commonwealth of Kentucky had been written. Not far from the town was the residence and grave of the state's first governor, Isaac Shelby. It could be said that Kentucky started in this region, so it seemed appropriate that its fate during the Civil War would be decided here in 1862.
Perryville had about 400 residents in 1862, and that January had marked its 45th anniversary as a chartered city in Kentucky. The area was settled in the 1770s by Pennsylvanians, led by James Harbison, and the locality was first known as Harbison's Station. The first settlers had been drawn to the location because of the Chaplain River and a natural spring located in a cave near the river's west bank. Indian raids had held back the settlement's growth somewhat, but by the early 19th century, it had grown into a healthy town. In January 1817, the settlement was chartered as a city and named Perryville, in honor of Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry, the hero of the Battle of Lake Erie during the War of 1812.
Four major roads provided Perryville with excellent links to Harrodsburg to the northeast, Danville to the east, Lebanon to the southwest, and Springfield to the west, while smaller roads connected it to the tiny hamlets of Mitchellsburg to the south and Mackville to the northwest.
In 1862, Perryville's active commercial district was centered along the Chaplain River's west bank, and the section of town was known as Merchant's Row. The surrounding area featured many farms of varying sizes, with the largest being Henry Bottom's place. Squire Bottom's 600 acres were located on the Mackville Road.
Perryville had so far escaped the war. Aside from wagons shuttling between Bardstown and Camp Dick Robinson, there had been very little military activity in the area before the Confederates and Federals arrived in October. As Perryville's residents realized their town was about to become a battlefield, many of them hurriedly packed up and fled on the night of October 7th and the early morning of the 8th. A few locals decided to ride out the coming storm in their cellars, but most people left town while the getting was good.
As the light faded on the evening of October 7th, Hardee deployed his two left-wing divisions in and around the town, with Simon Bolivar Buckner's division to the west and Patton Anderson's division to the northwest. Cheatham's division of Polk's right wing camped a few miles north along the Harrodsburg Pike.
Buckner's westernmost unit was a tough all-Arkansas brigade led by Brigadier General St. John Little. Little's outfit was initially deployed on Bottom Hill, a mile west of Perryville, but he quickly realized that a height to his front, known as Peters Hill, actually commanded the surrounding area.
By moving forward to occupy Peters Hill, Little would gain the added bonus of having access to Doctor's Creek, which ran along the hill's western edge and was one of the few decent water sources in the area. An additional tactical bonus was that the Springfield Pike crossed Doctor's Creek before climbing Peters Hill, and so any federal advance would be channeled through that spot.
Little kept most of his men on Bottom Hill, but sent the 7th Arkansas to occupy Peters Hill and watch for the Yankees.
Leonidas Polk arrived during the night and assumed command of the 16,000 or so Confederate troops in and around Perryville.
West of town in the Federal Third Corps bivouac, Bill Sheridan's 11th Division on the Springfield Pike was positioned closest to the rebel lines. Sheridan was aware of Doctor's Creek, which represented the best water supply he and his thirsty soldiers had encountered since leaving Bardstown. In fact, some of Sheridan's men had already snuck out beyond the picket line to get at the water in the creek.
Sheridan fully expected there would be a battle come morning, and he wanted his men to start it with full canteens, so he requested and received permission to secure the creek and the hill beyond. Sheridan gave the job to his newest brigade and its equally green commander, Colonel Daniel McCook, and his 36th Brigade of 1 Ohio and 3 Illinois regiments. The colonel, who had raised the 52nd Ohio that summer, was one of the Fighting McCooks of Ohio. He was the younger brother of First Corps Commander Alexander McCook.
Sheridan gave the assignment to secure Doctor's Creek and the hill beyond to Daniel McCook because although all of the 36th Brigade's regiments were untested in combat, they had nevertheless already impressed Sheridan with their discipline and the quality of their leadership. Sheridan knew that maneuvering and fighting at night was a risky business, but a near full moon would aid visibility as McCook's men moved forward.
At 3 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, October 8th, the 52nd Ohio started eastward toward Peters Hill. 30 minutes later, the regiment, with the 86th Illinois following in support, had crossed Doctor's Creek and started up the slope of Peters Hill. The 7th Arkansas was caught off guard by the Yankees' nighttime advance, and after a short but sharp exchange of fire, the Arkansans fell back to Bottom Hill. And so within an hour after starting off, Dan McCook's Federals had control of the water in Doctor's Creek and had secured Peters Hill too. As the 52nd Ohio's commander later reported, quote, "To the 36th Brigade and to the 52nd Regiment, thus attaches the honor of opening the great and decisive battle of Perryville."
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is Perryville, This Grand Havoc of Battle by Kenneth W. Noe.
Noe's book is the most comprehensive account of the 1862 Kentucky campaign and the most detailed narrative of the Battle of Perryville itself. Perryville, for some reason, is probably one of the least written about major battles of the war. So if you're interested in learning more about this clash that decided the fate of the Bluegrass State, then Noe's book is a must-have for your Civil War library. That's Perryville, This Grand Havoc of Battle by Kenneth W. Noe.
Don't forget you can find all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org. Also at the website, you can find links to the podcast Facebook page and Twitter feed.
And at the website, you can join the Strawfoot Brigade. And once you become a member, you can have access to 60 extra episodes. And just a shout out to the newest members of the Strawfoot Brigade, Bernie and Charles.
And thanks to Richard Kay for his donation this past week.
We also want to say a thank you to Spiritwood Music for their permission to use their song Midnight on the Water as the music you hear at the beginning and end of every episode of the podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Rich and I do hope you'll join us again next time as we continue with the story of the Battle of Perryville. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.